That was the perfect introduction to this talk. And it's really, it's always a pleasure and an honor to come back and join you and in your newly renovated, re-renovated, I remember, you know, the old space. And I thought this was the new space, but now it's the new space. It's really kind of cool. Jo set the stage beautifully when she talked about the burning bush out there, because that's actually what the first of three readings that'll frame this talk is about. So the first reading will be familiar and maybe not one that gets used too often in Unitarian churches, but I'm going to use an excerpt from the book of Exodus from the Old Testament. So discernment in the digital age is the topic, and I'm going back to a pre-digital age to start. So now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why this bush does not burn up. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to the bush to look, God called out to him from within the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what's his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am that I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent you to me. Okay, we're going to fast forward many, many centuries. And the second reading that's related to the first one in a way is from a strange man named George Fox, who was the founder of the Religious Society of Friends, or Quakers as they were called, because they shook a lot apparently when they talked. And this is from George Fox's journal. It was written in 1647, this particular passage, when he was beginning to discover that he had a message that people didn't really want to hear. And he was roundly being beaten and thrown out of existing churches and rejected by just about everybody for what he was trying to say. And he writes in his journal, and when all my hopes in all men were gone, so that I had nothing outwardly to help me, nor could I tell what to do, then I heard a voice which said, there is one, even Christ Jesus, that can speak to thy condition. And when I heard it, my heart did leap for joy. Then the Lord did let me see why there was none upon the earth that could speak to my condition, namely, that I might give him all the glory, for all are concluded under sin, and shut up in unbelief as I had been, that even Jesus Christ might have the preeminence, who enlightens and gives grace and faith and power. Thus when God doth work, who shall prevent it? And this I knew experimentally. So, these two readings suggest we're hearing about two apparently ordinary but somewhat odd men at very different points of history, both claiming to have heard the voice of God. Both are fairly certain and clear about what they've experienced, what they've seen or heard. And both incidents are foundational to two significant religious traditions, Judaism and Quakerism. Now, it's interesting to think that if Moses and George Fox reported these experiences today, we'd likely describe both of these men as psychotic and suggest that psychiatric care combined with strong psychotropic medications might help them manage their conditions, preventing further decompensation and, as Jo will remember from her working days, possible threats to either themselves or the general public. And yet, there's something about the experiences of both of these men that people have found, either for centuries in the case of Fox or millennia in the case of Moses, extremely compelling. There's something there in what these guys are talking about. Something they've discerned for themselves as an inescapable truth. Something they're very certain about. Something they've experienced so directly, so powerfully, so experimentally, as George Fox describes it, that they can't deny it. And it claims an overwhelming place in shaping the work and the deeds that dominate the remainder of the lives of these guys. So what's precisely going on in these stories? Well, I'm not very sure, and neither are the best historians or psychologists. So as often is the case for me when I'm trying to understand some of these strange dimensions of what the Dalai Lama calls the theistic desert religions, I often look to other faith traditions to help find the subtler lessons here. And in this instance, I turn to Buddhism and the teachings of Ajahn Lee. I don't know if anybody is familiar with him, but they offer me some insights. Here's what Ajahn Lee writes. What does discernment come from? You might compare it with learning to become a potter or a tailor or a basket weaver. The teacher will start out by telling you how to make a pot, sew a shirt or a pair of pants, or weave different patterns. But the proportions and the beauty of the object you make will have to depend on your own powers of observation. Suppose you weave a basket and then take a good look at its proportions to see if it's too short or too tall. If it's too short, weave another one, a little taller, and then take a good look at it to see if there's anything that still needs improving, to see if it's too thin or too fat. Then weave another one, better looking than the last. Keep this up until you have one that's as beautiful and well-proportioned as possible, one with nothing to criticize from any angle. What you've done is to learn from your own actions. As for your previous efforts, you needn't concern yourself with them any longer. Throw them out. This is a sense of discernment that arises of its own accord, an ingenuity and a sense of judgment that comes not from anything your teachers have taught you, but from observing and evaluating on your own the object you yourself have made. So now you're as confused as I am, right? How to put all of this together. So let's take a deeper dive. How do we know anything? Really know it? Now, I'm certainly not going to answer this core epistemological question in a brief Sunday talk, but I am going to wrestle with the question for a few minutes in the context of an age and an environment in which we have increased access to virtual tools that claim to connect us to absolutely everything we know or might ever want to know. It's an age, however, that leaves me increasingly concerned that in thinking we can know everything, we're actually at risk in being able to know and discern less and less with any certainty, with less and less of the sureness that Moses and George Fox had about what they knew, as Fox put it, experimentally. Today, we have access to information tools that we couldn't have dreamed of even 25 years ago. The power of the digital age provides access to storehouses of data and knowledge, which give us immediate, highly gratifying access to lots and lots of information. It's actually addictive. How many times in the last few months have I been engaged in a thoughtful conversation at dinner or at work and come to an impasse about what we know or a disagreement about the facts and pulled out my laptop or my smartphone for that GAC, right? GAC, that Google Assisted Conversation, right? Let's look it up. It's a GAC. Now, when I was younger, we would have headed to the libraries a day or two later to research such questions. Libraries were warehouses of information and knowledge. The more books a library could boast they held on their shelves, the more knowledge they claimed they stored. All that has changed. The internet offers access to tens of thousands more types of knowledge than even the biggest libraries. And libraries, to survive, are becoming places where we don't merely store knowledge, but we explore it. That's a different topic for a different day. So with access to endless information on just about any subject, one would think that the digital age would make us keener, smarter, more informed people, that increased access to knowledge would make us even better knowers of the truth, ever better able to discern experiential knowledge from inexperienced uncertainty. We should be able to better test what we may hear from a burning bush or know the site of that perfect woven basket. But sadly, I think too often we're going in the opposite direction. With the digital age has come the desire to speed up communications, to accelerate certainty, to truncate complexity and obscure pathways to discernment. Take Twitter, for example. I love Twitter. I tweet multiple times a day, usually on work-related topics about homelessness. You can actually follow me at @DavidWSeattle. There, I've advertised my Twitter account. Right? And I like to think that people read my tweets sometimes, that I influence some of what they may think about and how they think about it, and bring more focus and compassion to their attitudes about homelessness. But despite my efforts to be a good social media maven, I may not be having the impact or the influence I'm seeking. What happens to communication, to information, to conveying of the facts, to the activities that are crucial to discernment when you're limited to 140 characters of text, which is what a tweet is? Now, if I'd been tweeting when Moses was around and saw that burning bush, I might have tweeted the following. Skeptical shepherd distracted by bizarre burning bush hears voice telling him it's God and that it's his destiny to be the liberator of enslaved Israelites. One extra character left, 139 characters. Or for George Fox, I might have tweeted, millenarian extremist falls into depressive funk, determines his future happiness and security is dependent on disembodied voices. What have I communicated here? How accurate is that information? How complete? How subjective? What would a reader conclude from such a truncated telling of two such complicated stories? And I think that how we communicate about what we know has deteriorated significantly over the last centuries. Within the past 130 years or so, telephone calls replaced face-to-face conversations and the art of writing letters. How much did we lose when that face-to-face communication vanished, or when the carefully contemplated construction of a letter gave way to much more casual words spoken over a distance? Before the start of this century, even voice-to-voice conversations were replaced by emails, those truncated communications that let your fingers do the talking and are so easily misconstrued or misunderstood as the nuance of the letter or even the tone of a phone call are completely lost. How often have I sent an email that was completely misunderstood by somebody because they couldn't get the tone of what I was saying? And it doesn't even stop there. For any of you with young people in your lives, and for me it's two 11-year-olds and a 14-year-old, phone calls and even emails are utterly passé. Even tweeting takes up too much time and too many keystrokes. The easiest way to get their attention is to text them, right? And the bare-bone responses that I get tell me little more than that they're alive and still have a firm grip on their devices, right? A recent conversation with one of my 11-year-olds. How was school today? Texted. K. What would you like for dinner? Pizza. We're going to eat at home tonight. OMG, yuck. That's rude. LOL. Now, other than the fact that these kids are still breathing and a bit rude, what can we discern about them? And what can they actually discern about us or the world around them? It's scary to think about the answers to these questions. And to make matters worse, the tools that they and so many of us are using are so addictive. We have a rule at the dinner table. No devices. Just conversation. It's amazing that after the third time the 14-year-old in my life excuses himself to go to the bathroom during dinner, how quickly you can interrupt that behavior by telling him it's perfectly okay to go to the bathroom as much as you like, but please leave your smartphone on the table. Suddenly, the calls of the bladder have vanished. Now, maybe we're just not with the times, right? Maybe my parents thought I was addicted to reading books and I had a hard time putting them down to come to dinner or turn off the lights at night. It's possible. But think about the rich experience, the knowledge I was deriving from diving wholly into the world of a book and the subtle fabric of a well-crafted story. How much more could I learn and know from reading a great novel or a nonfiction title that I could than I could derive from hovering in front of my computer screen and joining the 2,125,381,326 other people around the globe who have watched Gangnam Style on YouTube? And no, I'm not making that number up, and it's probably several thousand higher than it was when I looked it up yesterday. What concerns me here is that by connecting with each other virtually, by allowing ourselves to be overwhelmed by the amount of information that's out there and our access to it, we're actually disconnecting from ourselves, from each other, and from the realities of our experience. Experiences that can lead to the intensity of finding a burning bush or the experimental knowledge that comes from the painful search for connection to people and things that should mean the most to us. And this is not even taking into account the accuracy of or the integrity of the information that we can find in the world of virtual knowledge. So much out there is so truncated, so fabricated, so pre-digested that our ability to trust the experiences we do have with all the data coming at us are reduced to almost nothing. And yet we eat it up, trusting that if we find on the internet, if it's there, or other forms of 21st century communication, if it gets repeated enough, it must be true. There's a reason that more than 30% of Americans believe that Barack Obama is a Kenyan Muslim. It's because Fox News keeps telling us that's the truth, fair and balanced. And even I fall prey to these challenges. A friend posted on Facebook a couple weeks ago that actress Betty White had died at the age of 92. I was so upset. She was a childhood hero, right? When I looked up from my laptop, which is, of course, where I saw it, and told my husband the sad news, he said, "Wait a minute." And he went back to the internet, Google-assisted conversation, and proved the Facebook posting completely wrong. Betty White lives. Now, what is all of this doing to our ability to discern the truth? Well, it isn't helping. With so much information coming at us, with so much speed, with our incessant desire to reduce those communications to briefer and briefer sound bites or keystrokes, what's happening not only to our ability to know fact from fiction, but to know for ourselves what is real? How do we discern what our truths are, how we know them to be real, and how they continue to unfold in our lives? It's becoming harder and harder. Now, Malcolm Gladwell, the brilliant author and storyteller, has written an informative book called Outliers. If you haven't read it, I commend it to you. In this book, he looks at those individuals who really know what they're about and what they do, and are able to do it brilliantly. And he uncovers the very simple truth about how it is they've gotten so good at what they do. It's purely this. They've done it tens of thousands of times and mastered the skills and knowledge required to do what they really do well. We're back to our Buddhist basket weaver. Do something enough times and you'll get better at it. Do it even more times and you'll get great at it. Do it endlessly and you may actually create a perfect basket. Now, how real is the risk that in the digital age we've lost this ability to achieve mastery at anything other than tweeting and keystroking? To be so familiar with something that we really know it, that we can really discern the truth about it, that we can trust deep experimental knowledge that was accessible to Moses and George Fox, a knowledge that yields insight, certainty, and understanding. Where do we get that today? This leads me to contemplate my own life. And about where in my life I found that experimental knowledge that leads to the certainty that grounds my experience of the world and keeps me from drowning in existential uncertainty like Fox, forever questioning what's real and what's fabrication. And certainly not what I read in the newspaper or can find on the internet. I have to get closer to it than that. I have to be able to feel it, to experience it, to touch it, to taste it. And that means getting up from my computer screen, putting down my smartphone, and to cease and desist from tweeting, texting, and Instagramming in order to bask in experience long enough to trust my experimental knowledge of the world, long enough to discern the wonder of a burning bush that's not consumed, or a still small voice within that tells me to trust my place in the world. Now, where do I find that? Well, as the children today were telling us, it's actually all around us, if we just pause long enough to hear it, to see it, to smell it, to taste it. I find it, for example, in long walks on the beach, as one young woman did this morning. There I experience the rhythm of the tides, the hovering and dives of the kingfisher, the smell of salty air, the slow but steady decay of a glacial bluff in repeated winter storms. But I must allow myself to listen to and absorb those truths, to open myself to the songs of the universe around me, or else I will continue to miss the experiences that lie at the core of my experimental knowledge. I'll walk right by that burning bush without even noticing it's there. And I still do that all the time. This past summer, an old friend of mine from New York City days came out to visit me on Guemes Island. And I moved from an island of 3 million to an island of 600, and my friends in New York still think I'm a little nutty for having done that. Now, he's a dyed-in-the-wool city boy, and I enjoy showing him, or so I thought, a world where the pace and priorities are very different. And what matters most is all around you to soak up and enjoy if you pause long enough to appreciate it. So my husband Paul and I took him out one morning in our little boat, and we headed towards Washington Park, the corner of Anacortes, with a planned destination of Deception Pass to have him experience those wild tides moving through Deception Pass, a familiar trip I've done many, many times. Love that trip. And as we motored along, this dyed-in-the-wool New York friend said, "I think I just saw a whale." I shrugged it off. I said, "My friend, perhaps you just saw a big fish. Maybe a porpoise, but so close to Anacortes, not a whale." On we went. I was certain in my unknowing. And I was set in my route, not open to something that might surprise me. A minute later, he said, "There it is again." So Paul stopped the engine long enough to turn around and allow us to search out over the water where my friend was pointing. And there they were. Not just a whale, but an entire pod of orcas. In our rush to get to Deception Pass, we'd completely missed what was right in front of us. Realizing we were in the midst of a slowly moving pod of magnificent creatures, we kept the engine off and we drifted along with them in the outgoing tide for more than an hour and a half. It was magical. You could hear their breathing. You could see their plumes. You could watch them slap the water with their giant flukes, sending messages to each other that I could not comprehend. The rhythm of their rising to the surface and gently breaking out of the water was, I'm sure many of you have experienced, mesmerizing. And for those moments that they swam alongside our drifting boat, I discerned a very powerful sense of connectedness to the world, of a rootedness in place, of a certainty of wonder and of pleasure, tempered only by my awareness of the fragile balance in which these magnificent creatures hang. The whales were, in a way, a burning bush of divinity that was passing directly into my consciousness. We never made it to Deception Pass, but we returned to Guemes Island with a deep, wondrous appreciation for this place in which we live and the brilliant potency of the world around us. We were giddy with the contact we'd made with something so much greater than ourselves. In their own way, these whales were singing the ancient song, "I am that I am." On that day, the whales helped me hear the sounds of the planet's music and experience all over again the extraordinary power of the web of creation, of which we're but a tiny thread. These were creatures that, over many, many thousands of years of passing, had become a perfect woven basket. Nothing that I could ever find on the internet, nothing I could email or text or tweet, will ever come close to the power and extraordinary grace of those moments floating alongside the orcas. Nothing. And this I know experimentally.